Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frank, set the controls this morning. There are some 28 million Kurds living around the Middle East. They are often referred to as the world's largest stateless people. They have no country to call their own. They have also become highly visible actors on the world stage and essential to understanding the modern-day Kurds and their demands for an independent state is understanding the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with journalist Eliza Marcus. She is one of the first Western reporters to meet with PKK rebels and has produced a history of the Kurdistan Workers Party. The book is entitled Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. The book is published by the New York University Press. And this morning, we'll be talking about it and about the PKK with Eliza Marcus. She's a former international correspondent for the Boston Globe, and she covered the PKK for more than 8 years as a freelance reporter for the Christian Science Monitor and also as a staff writer for Reuters News Agency. She received a National Press Club Award for her reporting. She's also a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation grant for her work. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here you have questions, comments, you can give us a call. Ms. Marcus, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I'm told I've been mispronouncing your first name. Eliza is...
Eliza, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. First, I suppose, a little bit more background about the Kurdish people. Who are they? And perhaps more importantly, where are they?
Well, they're Kurds. As you said earlier, there are about 28 million Kurds in the Middle East, and they're divided among Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And they've never had their own state, and to differing degrees in these different countries, they've always been repressed in one way or another. And currently, as you know, in Iraq, the Kurds have sort of a mini-state autonomy, the Kurdistan Regional Government there, ever since the U.S. invasion of Baghdad to overthrow Saddam Hussein. In Iran, they're highly repressed. In Turkey, they're also repressed, and by that I mean their language. They have difficulty expressing their language. You can't have Kurdish language education, difficulty publishing newspapers, and similarly in Syria. And the reason these countries have repressed their Kurdish populations to varying degrees is that fundamentally they're afraid that the Kurds will want their own state. And in fact, there have been various Kurdish independence movements or autonomy movements in most of these countries, but most especially in Iraq, Turkey, and also in Iran.
Mm. And I suppose one of the questions one would ask is that how the success of the Iraqi Kurds perhaps influences people's thinking, other Kurds, in the way that they think about the need for, the desire for an independent state. But overall, would you say that if you polled a majority of Kurds in all of these places and asked them about the independent state, the majority would say ultimately, yeah, that's really what we would like to see?
I think if you polled them, there's two issues here. If you polled them, well, one, you can't have a free poll in these countries. That's the biggest problem. So we don't actually know what Kurds want, because nobody could ask them that question. It just simply wouldn't be allowed in these countries. But I think if they could answer freely, I think many of them don't really know. I think the idea of independence or autonomy is always there, whether it's something they actually want or it's some sort of dream, the idealized version. But I think they don't know what they want, and the reason is because they've never really been able to discuss it freely. And what's happened in Iraq for the first time has given Kurds a real model of what they might aspire to. And this has emboldened Kurds in Syria, in Turkey, and in Iran to make more demands. It's led to further fighting, especially by Kurds in the Turkish-based PKK, the rebel movement, also among some Iranian Kurds who have joined a new rebel movement. And I think this has become a real problem for the states in the region, this Iraqi-Kurdish autonomy situation. That's become a problem for the states in the region, because it's given the Kurds in these other countries a model, something that they can point to and say, wait a second, if the Iraqi Kurds can have this, and they can have it in a unified Iraq state. Why can't we have something similar?
Mm-hmm. And just, again, to underline something that you said, particularly when it comes to Turkey, since we're talking about the PKK, you would say that Kurds in Turkey, perhaps also in Syria, perhaps also in Iran, have reason to complain about how they have been treated.
Yes, they certainly have reason to complain. And, of course, you know, to a certain extent, some of the problems the Kurds face are just the problems anybody faces in an imperfect democracy or a dictatorship, something like Syria or a country with theocratic rule like Iran, or in Turkey, which I would call an imperfect democracy. So, I mean, they face problems that almost anybody would face, but they face special problems as a substantial minority because these governments, and if we want to give Turkey as an example, the Turkish government, for example, has always been afraid of the Kurdish minority, that the Kurds would demand a state. And to a certain extent, they have the right to be afraid because since Turkey was founded in 1923, the Kurds have revolted in one way or another. And this has been a real threat to Turkey. And this is part of the problem and the tension between the Turks and Kurds.
Just perhaps, again, one more sort of general point. You talked about the fact that because you can't go out and ask them, one would have a hard time answering this question, well, what is it the Kurds want and how many of them would support an independent state? As far as an independent state, Kurdistan goes, as far as the rest of the world is concerned, or at least all of the countries that we're talking about that have significant Kurdish populations and the United States, and I don't know, perhaps Europe too, no one besides the Kurds seems to be interested in the idea of an independent Kurdish state.
No, that's true. Nobody really. I mean, I think Western powers, the United States especially, they see a Kurdish state as potentially destabilizing to the region, largely because it's something that would cause problems for Turkey. If there was an independent Kurdish state even in northern Iraq, if that split off, this would further embolden Kurds inside Turkey. It could cause new problems with the Turkish government. It could cause the current level of fighting between the Kurdish rebel movement and the Turkish soldiers to escalate even further. Likewise, this could happen in Iran. It could happen in Syria. So I think the problem for the West is that, on the one hand, the Kurds aren't that well known, so it's not a problem that's been burning in people's minds. But from a political perspective, the problem is that a Kurdish state would really be unfortunate. You know, it would be a problem for the other states in the region, and I think the West just doesn't want to insert another, isn't interested in promoting something that would create yet more tension, a new problem in that region. Hmm.
Did the fact that the autonomous Kurdish region in northern Iraq, the fact that it exists and it's there with the blessing of the United States, has that caused a problem, difficulties between the governments of Turkey and the United States?
It's caused a lot of tension between the governments of Turkey and the United States, definitely. And the tension is focused on the fact that in that Iraqi Kurdish region are the bases of the PKK rebel movement. That's the Turkish Kurdish group that's fighting the Turkish state. So Turkey says, on the one hand, they don't support this Iraqi Kurdish autonomous zone. They refuse to recognize the status of the Kurdistan regional government. They've never held an official visit with the prime minister of that government, with the president of the Kurdistan regional government. And but they really say that if the United States is going to allow this to continue to exist there, and at the same time the United States says that it's fighting a war on terror, Turkey says, fine, then push out the PKK bases from northern Iraq. Don't allow Turkish Kurdish rebels to use those mountains to attack us. And the United States hasn't taken real action against this rebel movement, and that's really at the root of the problem at this point between Turkey and the United States, because I think Turkey understands that the Iraqi Kurdish region isn't going to disappear. It's there to stay. You know, Iraq has really changed now. So they're trying to leverage this, however, to get pressure to push out the Turkish Kurdish rebels.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Elisa Marcus. She's a former international correspondent for the Boston Globe. She covered the PKK, that's the Kurdistan Workers' Party, for more than 8 years as a freelancer for the Christian Science Monitor and also as a staff writer for Reuters news agency in New York. She's the author of a book that was published last year about the PKK. The title of her book is Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. The book is published by the New York University Press. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Others are welcome. All we ask callers is people just are brief, and we just ask that so we can get in as many as possible. The number, by the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455. That's the one for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Lee County on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good topic. You know, this thing with Kurdistan, well, just basically in the Middle East, why can't they have just states? Like, we do have states here, you know, have a, you know, like Iraq have a state of Kurdistan and a state of Sunnis. And, you know, it just seems to me those people out there are not looking at it like we would look at it here. And I'm really surprised that nobody's brought that fact up, you know. The other thing is, too, I've studied the Middle East for quite a while in school, and I'll tell you what, I don't know if you'll ever please anybody over there. We're having problems ourselves in this country, and so when people look at us sometimes for help, I start laughing. As messed up as we are today in our republic, by the way, not a democracy, it's a republic. To me, it makes no sense that other countries would look at us and try to model after something like we do. But in the sense of that maybe, you know, statehood in a country like, you know, like I said, Kurdistan, you know, Iraq should have Kurdistan and then some Sunni tribal things and the same thing with Iran and all that. I want your comment. I'll get off. Thanks.
All right. Well, again, I guess that again gets back to this question, and it makes you think about Iraq, the possibility in some of these other countries for a kind of autonomous region, not independent, but with as much local control as you can give them, some kind of autonomous Kurdish state, region, province within that national state. Is that something that's at all possible in talking about places like Syria, Iran, and Turkey?
Well, I think it's definitely something that's possible, but Iraq offers a sort of cautionary model, because in Iraq, that's where things are moving, where you have, you know, strong regions, the Kurdish region, you have the Sunni region, you have the Shiite region. But the problem really is, how do you control the resources? Who gets the money from the oil? How do you distribute this? You know, who decides foreign policy? And this is something they're still working out in Iraq. I mean, we it took us a long time to figure it out, and we started so long ago that maybe the issues were a little bit different. I think it's definitely something that in Turkey, in fact, it is something in Turkey that the Kurds have been promoting through. They do have a legal Kurdish political party inside Turkey, and that party has put forward a plan that would set up a type of regional autonomy, not just for Kurds, but throughout Turkey. It's something that could be applied. I think it would be difficult to apply it in Syria. Just it's hard to know, because Syria is such a different situation right now, and political activity is so limited there that it's hard to see where it could go. It is something that could work in Iran, certainly, because you have different regions with different ethnic groups. But again, it becomes a question of, does the central government want to release power, want to give this up? And once you do give up this power and you allow regional autonomy, do these people then go on to demand independence? Because, for example, the Kurds may decide, I mean, they have always spoken about an independent Kurdish state. Even the Kurds in Iraq, who now have regional autonomy, they also still talk about wanting independence. So where does it stop? Do the Azeris in Iran decide that they want to link up with Azerbaijan? Now, these are sort of problems that I think the states are thinking. They're thinking three or four steps ahead and wondering whether, once they give up more rights to these minorities, does that mean that at some point they're going to actually lose control over that part of the land? And that's what's what's making it difficult to implement.
Well, I want to make sure that we here get into talking specifically about Turkey and the PKK. Perhaps the place to start would be to talk about Abdullah Öcalan, the man who was leader. I'm sure a lot of people still think of him as being the leader of the PKK, although he's in jail now in Turkey, and certainly was there at the founding of the organization. Tell us about him.
Abdullah Öcalan is remarkably still the leader of the PKK, even though he's in prison. He has a great hold over the organization, and people really see him as a symbol of their fight. He himself had, you know, a very common start. I mean, he was a university student in the 70s in political science. He dropped out and formed a rebel movement, which may seem unusual to us, but in Turkey it was happening constantly in the 70s. There were lots of different armed leftist movements and Kurdish movements and other groups. And he had the foresight to realize that he couldn't stay in Turkey anymore, that there was a military coup in the making, and he fled to Syria and brought some of his senior people with him. There was a military coup in 1980. Everything was shut down, and he was able to rebuild his organization in Syria. He's a very charismatic man. I've never met him, but many people who have spoken with him tell me that he had this sort of natural leadership about him, and he was very forceful and very focused on the idea of an independent Kurdish state. And it was this focus that drew in other Kurds, that and the fact that they had been severely repressed in Turkey after the coup, very severely repressed in Turkey after the coup and also prior to that. And they saw some sort of salvation in the rebel movement that he formed.
The movement certainly has been criticized for its willingness to use violence, and in fact is on the PKK is officially listed as a terrorist organization on the list of the United States and the EU and NATO. It seemed that from the start of the leaders of the PKK believed that only armed struggle would get them to their goal. Was there any serious attempt to approach this goal politically, to try in that way, in a nonviolent way, to gain recognition for the Kurds in Turkey?
Well, at the outset in the 1970s, when the group was founded, there was absolutely no political opening for Kurds, and that was why they went. One of the reasons they went towards armed struggle. But in the 80s and early 90s, Turkey democratized further, and there were more openings. And you had, for example, the start of a Kurdish political party in 1991. And in 1993, you actually had a ceasefire by the PKK because there were some kind of unofficial, very limited, the start of limited negotiations with the Turkish government. But the prime minister at that time, Turgut Özal, died suddenly, and everything died with him. So I think what's happened now is that the PKK has made it clear now for a number of years that it really would be willing to solve this through dialogue, that it's ready to declare a permanent ceasefire. And in fact, it's declared numerous short-term ceasefires over the years, partly to try to entice the Turkish government into negotiations. But the Turkish government steadfastly refuses to negotiate at all with the PKK. They say it's a terrorist organization, that it has no legitimacy. And that's one of the things that's really kept the PKK fighting.
It began as a communist organization. I think that still within the organization there is a commitment to socialism. How important to the PKK is political ideology?
That ideology was never really that political. I mean, it was something that was used. Yeah, they started as a communist organization, but it's not really clear. Were they a bit Stalinist, Maoist, Trotskyist? They sort of brought everything together. And you could join the PKK as with any ideology, but the main thing was, the shared ideology was that you were a Kurdish nationalist as well. So the ideology, I think, was useful partly as a means of control because they learned certain things. For example, they used to do these self-criticism sessions and some of the ways they structured it, very dictatorial. These were things they learned from their ideological heroes. But in terms of this being actually important to them, it really wasn't. What I found in talking to members of the group was that they really were focused on a Kurdish state. I mean, some were communists, some were capitalists, some were pro-America. It didn't really matter, and it didn't seem to matter to the leadership of the group either. What mattered was that they were willing to fight, that they were that they gave their allegiance totally to the PKK, and that they agreed with the ultimate goal of a Kurdish state.
Well, let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Effingham. This is line 4, again, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. Thanks, David. I have a question and if I might, a comment. Can you define what was known as the PUK? That
yes.
also was part of the, I think they were Marxist.
The PUK is the party that was formed by the Iraqi Kurdish leaders, now the president of Iraq, Jalal Talabani. It was a split-off from the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which was the main Iraqi Kurdish party that fought against Baghdad with U.S. support in the 60s and early 70s. And after that party was defeated, those fighters were defeated, the party split, and Talabani took his men and his supporters. And he was socialist. I mean, in that part of the region, pretty much everybody was. I mean, if you had a sort of liberation movement, you were a socialist. It was quite natural. And it was also a reaction to the fact that many of the Kurds there it was more of a feudal-based society. It was run by one man, a large landowner, and it was kind of a reaction to that and to the various monarchies and dictatorships in the region. So yes, it was that is the party. The party still exists today. It's called the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. It's in the government of the Kurdistan Regional Government. It's one of the two main parties in that government. And Talabani, I'm not sure if he's still officially the head of the party, but he certainly plays a large role, and he is the president of Iraq.
Yes, well, my comment is, earlier gentleman, I think before I called, alluded to a United States of Arabia, where they could all be nice fellows and get along and do the things they do, without understanding that the Middle East is still largely tribal entities, and as you said yourself, feudalist in its nature, which, you know, every social organization on the earth has gone through those times. And even at 1865, when the U.S. went through its civil war to defeat slavery, substituted for wage slavery, and the money and power all rose to the top again. That's the thing that that trivializes the sort of activity of most nations under the domination of capital. And so long as that paradigm exists, there is absolutely no change. They may change heads of these organizations and heads of state, just like it is in the U.S. The twin parties of capitalism are first and foremost obligated to the bourgeoisie. And the only way that will change then is for a people's movement, which cannot be denominated by or dominated by any specific progress, except if it is not based upon the masses. And so far, the masses are just a natural resource, and that's all they mean to the higher-ups. And unless there's not even really a United States of America, because they all have their little entities and their power structures that hang on the labor of the masses who pay all the bills and get all the work done, and yet they're just the floor upon which these upper class groups stand. Thank you, David.
All right. Well, you can comment on that any way you like, Ms. Marcus.
I think I'll just let it stand. It's an interesting point, and you know, I think it's just the experiences in the Middle East are varied and have to be looked at from different perspectives.
All right. Our guest is Aliza Marcus. She's a foreign correspondent, has been an international correspondent for the Boston Globe, and has done a lot of work covering the PKK, that is the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And she did that as a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor and also as a staff writer for Reuters News Agency. She received a National Press Club Award for her reporting. She's also a recipient of a MacArthur Foundation grant for her work. She's the author of the book Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, the book that was published last year by the New York University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we can talk a little bit more about the, and this obviously would make up a substantial part of the book, is about the continuing armed struggle between the PKK and the government of Turkey, something that has gone on from the beginning because, as you said, the people who started the PKK felt that there was really no opportunity for them to participate politically, that for them, they really saw armed struggle as the only possibility. And this is something that has gone on off and on now for decades, with peaks and valleys and with flare-ups and with ceasefires. Maybe you could just, in a general kind of way, sketch how this has gone now.
Well, I mean, the fight really started in 1984 when Öcalan at the time was based in Damascus, and it started off, at the time it was just a couple of shots fired, and the Turkish military actually did pretty well in rounding up a lot of PKK rebels. I remember one of the commanders telling me at the time that they were just shocked. They would send people across the border. At the time they had a few bases in northern Iraq, and the people, the next thing they would see was they were on television, you know, recanting and confessing, and everybody was caught. But the Turkish military, it did very well, and it withdrew from the region, and this gave the PKK the chance to regroup. And simultaneously, because of the time, the Kurds really saw no other outlet, and they had no other outlet. I mean, that was when the Kurdish language was banned completely, Kurdish names were banned. You had a great deal of torture in prisons in the Kurdish region. People really felt very angry, and they wanted revenge, and the PKK offered that. And the group just grew into a mass movement, mainly because of Öcalan's fixed vision and the fact that it was the only group that was fighting, that was active. And this just sort of had a snowball effect until by the early 1990s, they were a mass movement. They had cultural centers. They were developing a television station, which they have to this day in Europe, newspapers. And at the same time, they had a political... There was a Kurdish political party that was founded, and the PKK sort of infiltrated it, or its supporters came to the forefront of that party. So they were well entrenched in Kurdish society. The Turkish army, though, in the interim, really learned how to fight a guerrilla war, and they hit hard against the PKK from the mid to late 90s, and that it almost decimated the group in terms of its military power. And then in 1999, Öcalan was actually captured by Turkey after he was kicked out. Turkey threatened Syria, and he was kicked out of Syria. And he went on an increasingly desperate flight around the globe trying to find a country that would take him, and nobody would. He was ultimately caught in Kenya, where he was hiding, of all places, in the Greek embassy. And that really quieted the PKK. And by 2000, 2001, there was very little activity. I mean, people just left the group. The leader was in prison. He'd given this very embarrassing defense where he sort of apologized for the war. But what changed and what brought the PKK back to the attention of the world right now is the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the creation of this Iraqi Kurdish mini-state. And that revitalized Kurds, as we spoke earlier, this revitalized Kurds throughout the region, and no more so in Turkey, where they were used to having led the Kurdish fight and having made the Kurdish political demands, not just for themselves, but for all Kurds. And suddenly they saw that the Iraqi Kurds had gotten everything they wanted. And this revitalized the PKK. This caused Kurds in Turkey to throw their support behind the group again. And I think also Kurds in Turkey felt that they hadn't fought. The group had called a ceasefire in 1999 when Öcalan was captured. Between 1999 and 2004, they didn't do anything. And this was a perfect time for Turkey to respond, to bring Kurds in as equals to Turks. And Turkey did very little. And what it did was very grudging, and it did it mainly for its bid for the European Union. And I think Kurds just looked around and thought to themselves, you know what, we still can't get anything from the Turkish state. We're still not going to get something from the Turkish government. And they went back to supporting the PKK. And the PKK has really regrouped. It's gained a lot of fighters. It has a lot of support again among Kurds in Europe. It has a lot of control over the situation inside Turkey, and it's basically, once again, a force to be reckoned with.
I guess I'm interested in that assessment. It seemed to me, I guess I was wondering whether really it was kind of a stalemate in the sense that the Turkish government can't eradicate the PKK, but the PKK, there are serious questions about whether or not they could actually achieve their goals either, certainly questions about whether they could achieve them by using armed force.
Well, you're right. I mean, this is a type of stalemate, but it's a very dangerous stalemate because on the one hand, it makes it very difficult for Turkey to tackle other problems, especially when it comes to further steps towards cementing its democracy and really allowing full freedoms, because it has this rebel war on the side, and this makes Turkey, like other governments who have faced this, very, very nervous and sort of overcautious in what it allows people to do. At the same time, it's become a serious regional problem. Turkey has been bombing northern Iraq. They've threatened to invade northern Iraq. It's led to tensions between Turkey and the U.S., again, over these PKK bases, which are in northern Iraq. It's caused Iran to shell northern Iraq as well, because the PKK has formed an Iranian Kurdish group, which is now fighting against Tehran. So in that sense, it's a stalemate, but one that can explode at any time, and we just don't know when or what.
We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them. Next is someone in here in Champaign County where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Two things that you said sort of, I think, need a little expansion. And you mentioned that in the mid and late 90s, the Turkish army learned how to do counterinsurgency. That also doesn't point out the U.S. role. The U.S. was backing the attack on eastern Turkey with incredible amounts of support and weaponry. It was one of those, it's our guys doing it, so no one's going to make a big deal about the decimation of the people there. The other remark was about what happened in the early 70s. The PUK didn't lose the battle. The plug was pulled on them, and this was a U.S. involved thing as well. You didn't mention U.S. support, but the negotiations or the intermediate end that the U.S. was backing, and this was with a deal cut by Saddam Hussein about the Shatt al-Arab waterways, was cut, and the U.S. just pulled the plug, and it elicited the famous quote from Kissinger at the church hearings that covert action shouldn't be confused with missionary work. He basically said, well, they're dispensable, and the Kurds have always been used that way, and they're apparently being used that way now. I keep bringing up PJAC, which is the Comrades in Arms group with PKK, only they're attacking Iran. Many more Iranian soldiers have been, and the battles across the Iran border by PJAC have been much more bloodthirsty. I mean, 100, 200 Iranian soldiers killed in one battle that I recall. I think that's perhaps the reason why we can't, pull the plug on the PKK, is because we were actually using the Kurds in this realpolitik covert a way that no one seems to want to talk about very much. Cy Hirsch brings it up now and again, but it doesn't really. How would you react?
Well, no, I think you're right, and obviously you're right. I didn't mention that it was the U.S. Through Iran, which had been supporting the Iraqi Kurds in the late 60s and early, especially in the early 70s. And when Iran and Iraq, as you noted, came to an agreement, the U.S. ordered Iran to stop supporting the Kurds, and they did. And within days, everything had collapsed. And the Kurds fled to Iran as part of the agreement. Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, was himself based in Damascus for many years, and to a certain extent he was used by Syria just as he used Syria. I think this has been a serious issue for Kurds, and there are some Kurdish groups that, for example, decided not to fight because they didn't want to be used. They didn't want to be used by a country that was repressing its own Kurds, because that's part of the irony of what's happening in the Middle East. I mean, yes, there's U.S. involvement, certainly, but you also have to remember that while Iraqi Kurds were getting support from Iran, Iran was repressing its own Kurds, and they were using the Iraqi Kurds to attack Iranian Kurds. And while Syria was repressing its own Kurds, it was giving support to Öcalan and the PKK. So everybody's sort of using everybody else in that region, and I think what you have, the situation you have now, by the way, is that the Iraqi Kurds are trying not to be used. I mean, they're very forceful about what they want. They've laid it out. While they certainly listen to the United States and have excellent relations with the United States, they don't give in to the United States anymore because the balance of power has changed. And the PKK, for example, is now doesn't have any protector, really. I mean, it's based in the mountains of northern Iraq, but the Iraqi Kurds have no power to push them out. Those are very difficult mountains to deal with. And they're no longer supported by Syria. Iran no longer supports any of these Kurdish groups. So it's sort of shifted, I think, and that's what makes it almost more dangerous, because there's nobody to stop these groups anymore. Syria used to be able to exert a certain pressure on the Turkish Kurdish rebels. Iran, by pulling the plug on the Iraqi Kurds, was able to cause the collapse of their fight. That doesn't happen anymore. These groups have now independent power, independent sources.
What about PJAK and, you know, this role that I've outlined or that
PJAK is essentially a creation of the PKK. And although it's mainly Iranian Kurds, I mean, it still was founded by the PKK and owes its ultimate allegiance to Öcalan. I think the thing about PJAK is that while it has staged some rather from their view, effective attacks on Iranian forces, they don't really have, you know, I think much support or control in the Iranian Kurdish region. I mean, they're not, first of all, PJAK hasn't been around very long, just a couple of years. And they were formed from the outside. Well, the PKK has really, over the decades, you know, just as a comparison, has really built itself up into an organization with roots and support and, you know, chains of command and things like that in southeast Turkey among the Kurds there. PJAK, interestingly enough, is not on the U.S. terrorist list. The PKK is, PJAK is not, and as I'm sure you know, Turkey is very upset about this, and they don't understand why, since this group is clearly an offshoot of the PKK, the U.S. doesn't put them on the list, and Turkish conspiracy theorists and some others, maybe even Cy Hirsch, I think, have said that the reason is that the U.S. hopes to use PJAK against Iran. Could be true, could be not. I mean, it's impossible to know in this situation.
Well, I think he goes further and says that PJAK is currently being used. These battles are part of this attack on Iran through other means.
Well, let's not exaggerate. The attacks still are not going to bring down the Iran.
No, it's a matter of pressure. It's a matter, and if you combine it with all the other things, there are four or five different groups: the Baluchs, a number of groups that are all being covertly aided.
I actually don't believe that PJAK is being covertly aided. I don't think we're seeing that it's using the type of weaponry that would imply that they have access to something beyond the usual AK-47s that you can buy, you know, in the markets of Iraq. I think it's more a situation that the U.S. is quietly pleased about what PJAK is doing and doesn't want to interfere, and that's why they haven't put them on the terrorist list. And yes, it's possible they might occasionally have covert meetings, but I don't really see what the U.S. is giving them. I mean, I don't see it in what the weapons, the type of attacks, the things that PJAK is doing to say, yes, this is coming from the U.S. I think it's just the case that it pleases the U.S., it probably pleases some other countries, and they don't want to stop it.
Well, I understand that some howitzers and stuff were employed in some of these battles, and heavy weapons.
Well, they do have access. I mean, everybody's had, you know, the PKK has always had access to some heavy weaponry there, but it's still a fairly small group. And I think the U.S., you know, the U.S. Knows to be very careful there, because, I mean, they're not. The U.S. does see the link with the PKK, and they have to. They have to keep a certain distance from these things. I mean, let's put it this way. I haven't seen any real proof that the U.S. is actively supporting, but inactively, you know, certainly they like it.
We have about 10 minutes left. I have another caller. I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to get on to the next. Just again, too, for anybody who's tuned in, to introduce again our guest, Aliza Marcus. She's a former international correspondent for the Boston Globe spent a lot of time covering the PKK, that is the Kurdistan Workers' Party. And she's authored a book. This book was published last year. The title is Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. The book is published by the New York University Press. She's also worked for the Christian Science Monitor and the Reuters News Agency in New York and has received a National Press Club Award for her reporting. If you're interested in the book, you can certainly find it, I'm sure. Questions are also welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign. Line 2. Hello.
Hello, you got me.
Yes.
Is it possible to give an explanation why in the early days of what you've been speaking of, the U.S. had been supplying our locally stored poison gases to all of the nations from Turkey going east to destroy Kurds, and why, and that included Saddam Hussein, and why we simply seem to be using the area as a dumping ground for obsolete and malfunctioning weaponry.
I think it's, you know, the U.S. has always supplied those countries in the region with the weapons and has, you know, not paid a lot of attention to how these weapons are used. That's generally the U.S. policy. So we did have the poison gas attack by Saddam Hussein against the Kurds of Halabja in northern Iraq in 1988. That was very devastating and still is hurting the people in that region since then. In terms of a weapons dumping ground, I mean, most of the Middle East is a dumping ground for weapons, not just from the U.S., I think from pretty much everywhere. It's the one place where there was a time when, you know, you could buy a Kalashnikov for the price of cigarettes, and cigarettes were always very cheap in the Middle East. So, you know, I think that's just it's a function of the many wars that have been fought there and the fact that it's kind of a middle ground for transporting weapons both east and west.
All right, let's go on to somebody else here then. We'll go to Farina, or perhaps it's Farina, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I didn't hear you talk about the oil deal with the Hunt Brothers Connected Oil Company. Also, what is the isn't Kurdistan the most stable region in Iraq and the least occupied by American troops? And what is the major problem to granting them autonomy that they themselves want? It seems like it would without granting them autonomy, it would create another problem like the Palestinians in Israel. And I'll listen to my answer off the air.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. The Iraqi Kurds do have essentially autonomy now, and they have a lot of powers. I mean, that was granted to them in the constitution, and there's some issues that are still being worked out. For example, the oil law, and because there's disagreement between the central authorities in Baghdad and the Kurds over how to really apportion the money from oil deals and who gets to decide what oil deal. The Kurds have meanwhile gone on and started signing their own oil deal. They have their own oil law, which you can see if you go to their website, the KRG.org website. It's on there. And they have struck a deal with the Hunt Brothers, and they've struck deals with lots of oil companies in Europe as well. There's some question over the legality of this, not from the Kurdish perspective. I mean, they think it's totally legal, but from people in the central government of Baghdad and some outsiders who kind of wonder what this will mean when they do have a final agreement. And I think that this is one of the problems that we see that comes from when these ethnic groups get autonomy or federation, really the Kurds, it's almost a federation in a way, is that who controls the resources? Who gets the money? Because that's what it comes down to a lot, especially in Iraq, where the money is from oil, and who's going to control that, and both sides have an argument over that. And meanwhile, of course, oil companies want to explore. They want the money too. So they're happy to make a deal with pretty much anybody who seems to have effective control over the area. And right now the Kurds really do, because northern Iraq has never been occupied by American troops. I mean, there's maybe a few hundred American troops there, but it's a place that even Iraqi Arabs go for rest and relaxation, because there's no violence. It's perfectly safe. You do have the odd car bomb or something, but it's very minor and limited on the outskirts. And it's a place that is the most stable, and it's one reason why the United States doesn't want to challenge the Kurds, let's say, over these PKK bases that are in northern Iraq, because the United States understands that Kurdistan is its ally, that the Iraqi Kurds are really keeping control over this part of Iraq, and it's the last thing they want is a problem in Iraqi Kurdistan.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that the leader of the PKK, Abdullah Öcalan, was in 1999, he was captured by Turkey with, I believe, some assistance from the United States, and was taken back to Turkey, was put on trial, was found guilty, was sentenced to death. His death sentence was later commuted, so he's now serving a life in prison. Given his importance, given at least right now, the growing importance of the PKK, can you imagine him ever being let out of jail?
I can't imagine it. First of all, I think if he were let out of jail, somebody would kill him. I mean, you have, you know, let's say 70 million people in Turkey, from 20% are Kurds, and even among those Kurds, not everybody really likes Abdullah Öcalan. There are a lot of people in Turkey who would like to kill him. So that's one. I think practically speaking, it would be difficult. At the same time, I think for Turkey, you know, I think Turkey can go far in terms of recognizing Kurds, in terms of granting them further political rights, cultural rights. But I think there's a point that there's a line they can't cross, and that would be freeing Öcalan. I think that would be too difficult for them to accept, because in their minds, this is a man who's been responsible for the death of thousands of Turkish soldiers. I mean, his fighters have killed thousands of Turkish soldiers. He's, you know, led to economic problems. His fight has caused them problems with the United States. It's caused them problems in their relationship with Europe. And I just don't see them being able to see beyond his leadership of all this and ever let him free. They could do more to better his conditions. He lives in a prison on an island. He's the only inmate on this prison. Because it's an island, it's very difficult for boats to get there. It's often very choppy. And the boat that the Turkish government uses is not very seaworthy, and they haven't bought a new one. And so he doesn't get visitors very often. I mean, there are things they could do. They could put him in a prison with other people. They could get a better boat. They could allow better access, more visits. But releasing him, I just don't see that ever happening.
Mm-hmm. We're down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left here, and just maybe going back to the point I made all the way at the beginning, and that being that to understand the politics of the region, the politics in the Middle East, and to talk about what has gone on, what is going on, what will be going on, you really have to understand the Kurds. In what sort of role do you see, not just perhaps for the PKK, but for the Kurds in this region? What sort of role do you see for them when we talk about the future of the region?
Well, I think their role is large and only going to get larger, because on the one hand, you know, Iraqi Kurdistan, for example, can be a model just not just for Kurds, but the fact that it's peaceful, the fact that there's economic development, can be a model for other parts of Iraq as well. They can sort of lead the way that way. And I think the Kurds, because of their demands for greater autonomy in, let's say, Syria, Iran, and Turkey, are kind of a force for greater democratization as well. Because by virtue of demanding more rights, more freedom of expression, more political expression, this is a push for greater democratization as well. And I think that can be something positive for these countries, even as it causes problems in terms if they're also, you know, if they're also fighting a rebel war. But at the same time, these demands do help push democracy forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there, though, I guess you wonder, when you see the way that these countries, Turkey in particular, have responded to the assertion on the Kurdish part that they are a distinct ethnic cultural group, and that their rights should be respected, their identity should be respected, they should be able to speak their language and so forth, that, you know, one wonders if those governments would ever get to the point where they would even accept the Kurds as, in a sense, as a legitimate people and not trying to put as much pressure, again, I guess I'm mostly thinking about Turkey, as much pressure as they have on them to assimilate and give up their Kurdishness.
I think Turkey's a perfect example because, in fact, over the past two decades plus, Turkey has changed. Not only has it changed for Turks, but it's changed for Kurds. The language is no longer officially banned. You still can't study it in school. It's still not taught as a second language, let alone a first language. But people have been allowed now to give their children Kurdish names. You have a certain limited Kurdish language television, even as it's very much controlled by the Turkish government. And often the private stations are shut down or fined for broadcasting something the Turkish government doesn't like. You do have a Kurdish political party that has, over the years, now gained control of some municipalities in Turkey. And I think that, looking forward, let's say a few years, a decade, is going to be an important force for change for Kurds and for Turks, because controlling a municipality is, in a way, a type of autonomy, as limited as it is. And I think, using Turkey as an example, we see small steps. You know, in the aggregate, there hasn't been enormous changes. But along the way, things have developed in favor for the Kurds. And I think that hopefully will continue. Whether or not you need to have a continuing rebel war, I think, is one of the problems. If the PKK were to stop fighting now, would Turkey again declare victory as it did after Öcalan's capture and stop everything? And that's, I think, the Kurdish fear, and that's why they keep fighting. Because they don't know what happens when they don't trust that when they stop fighting, things will change. Mm.
Our guest, Aliza Marcus, has been international correspondent for the Boston Globe and also worked as a freelance reporter for the Christian Science Monitor and as a staff writer for Reuters News Agency in New York. She's the author of the book Blood and Belief, The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. It's published by the New York University Press. Ms. Marcus, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.